Coming up on Tech Nation, Alan Burdick, former senior editor at The New Yorker and National Book Award finalist for his first book, Out of Eden, An Odyssey of Ecological Invasion. He talks to us today about his latest, Why Time Flies. Then on Tech Nation Health, new efforts in bettering the long-term results of angioplasty and a clinical trial for osteoarthritis in the knee. We'll also hear from our chief correspondent, Dr. Daniel Kraft, on the future of medical education, not just doctors and nurses, but also for everyday people. All this coming up on this week's Tech Nation.
Let's take five with Moira Gunn. This is 5 minutes.
It's no longer news, it's history. Senator Elizabeth Warren was red-carded during her Senate testimony for reading a 30-year-old letter penned by Coretta Scott King, also a matter of public record. After a substantive cadre of senators from a political party not her own organized a vote to claim she had violated the infrequently invoked Rule 19, she was curtly informed the senator will take her seat. I said curtly, listen to the audio, comprehend the words themselves. This was no flight attendant settling the cabin prior to takeoff. Senator Warren gamely proceeded to go next door and read the letter into Facebook Live. Overnight, the video garnered over 6 million views while the incident hit the news cycle. Majority Leader Senator Mitch McConnell was clear. She was warned. She was given an explanation. Nevertheless, she persisted. Not exactly a friendly bunch by any measure. The following day, a number of Warren's male Senate colleagues read the very same letter into the very same congressional record in the very same Senate chamber. None were interrupted, much less Rule 19'd. Yes, Rule 19 has become a verb. While some have argued gender discrimination, anyone present would know that the Rule 19 gambit works only once if it's going to work at all. Or rather, the threat of invoking it, which we have come to understand is enough to settle most folks down. But not Elizabeth. No matter what your politics, this has all the earmarks of what makes a great story. Journalism comes to a rolling boil over what did they know, when did they know it, and what did they do when they found out. The ominous tone was set with she was warned. What could this possibly mean? Cornered in the hallway, the slow gesture of a beckoning hand to come and chat from party leadership? There's nothing written or recorded to be sure. These folks are too experienced for that. Yet they somehow thought that she would stop, unbowed by the specter of shunning, the prospect of shame. It's good to remember that the original rule was put into place in 1902 because a fist fight broke out in the Senate chamber. I keep thinking, wouldn't that have been great? My money would have been on Elizabeth. My real question is, with all the opposition rhetoric that Senator Warren is famous for, why did they choose this time when she was reading Coretta Scott King's letter? Or, and this would be so bad, maybe they had just planned it for a particular time and didn't plan on what she might be reading when they called for the Rule 19 vote. No matter what, they surely didn't plan on what she would do next. We may never know who came up with the idea to go immediately live on the internet. But that's exactly what the web is thirsty for. Some media call this the Streisand effect, when Barbara Streisand sued a photographer to stop him from taking photos of her Malibu home. And now we all know what Babs' crib looks like. But I find this depiction unsatisfactory. It focuses on the motives of the Rule 19 crowd and not the unbroken power of the silenced senator having her say, transforming it into a one-on-one reading to every viewer. A better sense of the person of Elizabeth Warren could not have been more palpably produced. It's the internet at its best, created by a shallow and dubious proposition, and the result, Elizabeth's truth unbound. I'm Moira Gunn. This is 5 Minutes.
Five Minutes is produced at the studios of KQED-FM in San Francisco. 5 Minutes is a production of Tech Nation Media. I'm Paul Lancour.
From San Francisco, I'm Moira Gunn, and this is Tech Nation. Today on Tech Nation, why time flies. Science has a lot to say about it, and it's a far richer subject than you might imagine. Then on Tech Nation Health, new efforts in bettering the results of angioplasty and a clinical trial for osteoarthritis in the knee. We'll also hear from our chief correspondent, Dr. Daniel Kraft, on the future of medical education. You might know Alan Burdick from his first book, Out of Eden, an Odyssey of Ecological Invasion, for which he was named a National Book Award finalist. His latest is Why Time Flies. Reading his book, I was reminded of the advice of my college speech teacher. He said, if you can't be good, be brief.
Yep. Stop talking.
Just stop talking.
Yeah. As soon as you don't know what you're saying, stop talking.
Yeah. You know, it's a question of time. You know, it's like when you don't have anything good and you keep going, it seems much longer.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, there was actually a study done in 1925 that found that lectures seem to last longer in the minds of people watching them than in the minds of people giving them.
As a professor, I'm profoundly aware. But what I find interesting about it, that remark, is that it speaks directly to the audience's experience of time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, I haven't parsed that particular example, but there is something about the fact that doing something, well, it takes your mind off the time. So ultimately, when you say that time speeds up or time slows down, what you're really saying is, I was keeping track of time or I was not keeping track of time, right? You know, if you're doing something, you're not really paying attention to the time. So naturally, it's going to go a lot faster if you're talking than if you're watching and you actually have the opportunity to look away and look at your watch.
And when I'm enjoying myself, time just flies, as they say.
Yeah, yeah. But the thing about time flying is that you will not notice it. By definition, you will not notice it until it's over.
It's like that's the catch 22. If you noticed it, time wasn't flying.
I know. When you sort of write it out in a sentence, it looks and sounds incredibly circular. But by definition almost, time flies by because you've stopped paying attention to it.
And when I looked at the subtitle to your book, A Mostly Scientific Investigation, I had to begin reading to realize that you move back and forth between science and technology and yours and other people's personal experience of time. How did that style come about? Did that you just started writing and you realized that's what you were doing? Or?
Well, it was kind of a combination of things. I knew from the outset that if I was going to tackle this subject, it had to be almost tactile. I mean, time is a lot of things, but, you know, it can really feel abstract and intangible. So I wanted to focus on, first of all, experiments, you know, where things actually happen or don't happen and can be fun. And you've got stuff to actually describe in the physical world. I really did not talk at all in the book, very much at all, about philosophy. There's a lot of discussion in the, you know, about the philosophy of time, and it all starts to swirl around in your head And I just wanted it to feel real, you know, because that is, I mean, time is this stuff in us. It's around us. It is, you know, it is, it's everywhere. And it is in things. And so by talking about those things, by talking about us, I could get at it. And then, I mean, the other piece is that, you know, the book took so long that, I ended up in a way kind of wrapping all of that within, I mean, it's definitely not a memoir, but you know, there is this trajectory of me becoming a parent and my kids growing up and watching what that means and watching their increasingly complex relationship to time develop.
You soon find out that time has many definitions, many experiences, many relationships, and our relationship with time is very individual. I mean, you wrote that for a time in your youth, you refused to wear a watch, and now, unless you literally refuse to have a phone,
yeah,
time is right with you all the time. You know,
yeah,
they're almost, you can't not.
It's hard to get away from.
You can't, hard to get away from our technological definition of time.
Yeah, yeah. And I think, you know, I did that, not wear a watch. I at a time really when I think this was all starting to happen, when cell phones were starting to become ubiquitous, when it really did begin to feel like time really is kind of everywhere now, and I want to get away from it. And as I got deeper into the book, I just realized what a delusion that is, in the sense that, you know, we have clocks in our cells, we have clocks in our bodies, you know, combined, they basically form a bigger clock, which is me as an individual. You know, there are all sorts of psychological aspects to time, and we share time, we bend time as we spend time together. That's integral to our sociality. And so it began to seem less onerous time began to feel less like a thing that was being imposed on me and more like an organic thing that, if I embraced, could actually benefit me.
Now, one aspect of this, of course, is the technology. Engineers are trying to build accurate measures of time, more and more accurate. I mean, the accuracy, the average person says, really, you need to go to this point. Why is it so difficult to build a completely accurate clock?
Ah, very good question. So there are basically two ways to tell time. And one way is from the top down. The Earth rotates every 24 hours exactly, and you can divide that up into, you know, exactly, 24 hours, 60 minutes in an hour, exactly 86,400 seconds in a day. So a second exists as a mathematical construct. It's the product of division, if you will. And that's how we told time for a long, long time. It started out that astronomers would sit in their observatories and they would watch the stars, and from that, through a complicated process, determine exactly when noon is. And then they would share that with, you know, they would set their clock, and then they would use their clock to basically, as the point of synchrony, send it out by telegraph. Or for a while, there were people who walked around with watches that they synchronized with the observatory and sort of sold that service to people in town who wanted to be.
This is really what time it is.
exactly. And so for a long, long time, that's basically how we got it. It came from the top down. And then in the 60s, in the 50s, 60s, scientists realized there was another way to tell the time, which was basically to create it. So they learned that a cesium atom vibrates 9 billion plus times per second. Now, per second of the top down 86,400 per day kind of second, right? And so you could have a cesium atom and you could count it, you know, count it to 9 billion plus vibrations, and you were, and you had a second. And then if you had a lot of those, if you had 86,400 of them, you could have a 24-hour day and you could tell the time of day. And so we
just
have,
keep watching the cesium atom and count, and you know what time it is.
Exactly. And the language for this is great. They these clocks, they don't tell, you know, they don't create seconds. They realize seconds. You know, so we have national clocks that are atomic clocks. We have a set of clocks in Colorado, and we have another set of clocks in Baltimore. And your watch, my watch, our phones, all ultimately through GPS or other means, tap into that time and synchronize with that time. Now, there are a couple of problems. One is that the bottom-up kind of second, the kind of second that our clocks now realize, does not exactly match the top-down kind of second. And the reason is because the Earth is very gradually slowing down in its rotation.
Ooh.
So
last year's year is shorter, is longer than this year's year.
Exactly.
Or is it vice versa?
Yeah. And this, you know, this second, this 86,400th of a day is very slightly longer than the 186,400,000, slightly longer than the 186,400th long second that came right before. And that difference is big enough that over, you know, every few years, we have to add a second, a leap second, to make up for the discrepancy between the top-down kind of second and the bottom-up kind of second.
But the cesium atom, it doesn't change.
The cesium atom does not change. It, the seconds we realize are, you know, they are the baseline. They are.
It just keeps vibrating at the same gazillion billion times every second, and that's what we're looking at. We could choose in the alternative to say a day is a day, and every year the, you know, how many seconds exactly, the top down, as you say, are there. And so we would change how many counts of the cesium atom, but we're not choosing to do that.
We're not choosing to do that in part because I mean, part of having an accurate clock is that it ticks at a reliable pace. You know that, you know, 1 second is exactly the same as the next second, and that enables you to have things like global positioning satellites who have, you know, which have to speak to other satellites, and they have to speak to targets on the ground, and they're relaying information that has to move at very high speeds. And, you know, that kind of precision is absolutely necessary for the kinds of technologies that we rely on, even without noticing these days.
And there's the other problem. It's not just one clock. It's a whole lot of clocks that have to depend on each other. Some of them are halfway around the world.
Yeah, well, that's where it gets weird. So, you know, you have a clock, and the way you know that it's accurate, the way you make sure it's accurate, is you compare it to a more accurate clock, and you set it accordingly. And, in, you know, in our case, that's a clock in Colorado or one in Baltimore. Well, so where do those clocks get their accuracy? Well, it turns out they don't have just one atomic clock out there. They've got about a dozen. And they all kind of speak to each other, and they kind of get an average. But even that is compared to a much more precise kind of atomic clock that isn't really ready for full-time use, but it uses rubidium. And so that's their gold standard. Meanwhile, France has the same thing going on. England has the same thing going on. Russia has the same thing going on. And of course, these national clocks need to talk to each other too. So they need some higher order standard to compare themselves to.
And when one clock asks another clock and the other clock what time it is, and the other clock sends it back, it takes time. So by the time the original clock gets the time, it's no longer that time with the clock that sent it.
Yeah, that is the weird thing about time and about this experience that we call now, whether it's right now on my watch, whether it's right now between us talking here, whether it's right now in my brain. Now is actually a manufactured product, and necessarily so. And it takes a little time to manufacture it. And there's no getting around it.
Mm. You're listening to Tech Nation. I'm Moira Gunn, and my guest today is Alan Burdick, a former senior editor at The New Yorker. You see his writing in just about any place you can think of, from The New York Times Magazine to Harper's to Discover and Best American Science and Nature Writing. You may also know him from his first book, Out of Eden, An Odyssey of Ecological Invasion, for which he was named a National Book Award finalist. His new book is Why Time Flies, a mostly scientific investigation. Well, it's interesting to me. I didn't really get, until I read your book, this notion of time with seconds and all that. That's a human invention. And yet we do have many things that have to do with time. You were saying some earlier, we're all familiar with circadian rhythm.
Right, right. So we all have circadian rhythms. I mean, the best way to think about your circadian rhythm is to not think about your sleep cycle, but to think about your body temperature, because that's really the most reliable indicator of your circadian rhythm. So by circadian rhythm, I mean that you have in your body a clock, a series of clocks, actually, that together tell almost a 24-hour period of time. And some people, it's a little shorter. Sometimes it's a little longer in other people. And it doesn't quite match the length of the day, but it is basically 24 hours long. All of your physiological processes follow a 24-hour rhythm. So your body temperature is lowest right before you wake up, and it is highest in the middle of the day. You know, your kidneys are less active at night and more active during the day. Likewise, your adrenal glands, and your liver is more effective during the day than it is at night. You're kind of worst at metabolizing alcohol at about 10 o'clock at night.
When many people drink.
When many people drink. Facial hair grows fastest in the afternoon, which is why a lot of men get 5 o'clock in the afternoon shadow, but not 5 o'clock in the morning shadow. This circadian rhythm, it's actually based in each of our cells. All of our cells have a 24-hour clock in them so that they can kind of organize their own activities within themselves. But they speak to each other. You know, they're all clocks talking to each other. And some talk to each other and form your liver. So your liver has its own clock. And others form your kidney, and that has its own clock. And we have in our brain a centralized conductor, if you will. It's a cluster of about 20,000 cells, and it is beating out, likewise, a very regular 24-hour rhythm that is keeping all those other clocks in line. You know, it's like conducting a symphony, and sometimes the woodwinds come in, and then the brass is going to come in. And it all flows very nicely thanks to this set of neurons in our brain. And the last step is, so that works pretty well as a 24-hour clock. And if you went into a cave or you went into a closet for a couple of weeks or a month, it would still tick out a 24-hour cycle. But because it's not exactly the same as the length of the day, you would actually fall out of sync with the 24-hour day. So you might be down there in your cave and you're thinking it's 12 noon, but actually, you know, after 2 or 3 weeks, it might actually be 4 o'clock in the afternoon. And the way that our circadian rhythms actually stay aligned with the 24-hour day is, again, this cluster of neurons in our brain that not only conducts all our inner clocks, but gathers information from the outside in the form of sunlight. And there are a couple of times a day when it is more, when this cluster is more sensitive to certain wavelengths of light. And that light essentially works to reset your circadian clock. I mean, it's like if you have, I don't know about you, but my clock on my dashboard of my car, it isn't, you know, it's not radio, you know, equipped or anything. It doesn't get the time from any other place. It doesn't synchronize with any other clock. So after about a week, you know, my watch will say 9 o'clock and it will say 9:03. So I have to physically reset it. And that is what the sun is doing every day to our circadian clocks.
Just not, a little reset.
Yep.
Just a little reset.
Not at every moment, you know, not at every moment of every day, you know, beginning of the day, end of the day. But just, you know, it's like a moderator, you know, just keeping the discussion on track.
Now, you went up to the Arctic in July, basically 24 hours a day sun. What was the experience of there? It doesn't get dark.
It was weird. I had never been in an environment like that. And this is, you know, this is like rural Alaska. We're north of the Arctic Circle. I'm with a group of biologists. They're actually there all summer, and it's this kind of big encampment. But, you know, we're essentially in the middle of nowhere. The sun literally does not set. And, you know, I'd read about that for years, and I couldn't quite believe it's true. But, wow, it's really true. And I realized that in my normal life, what sleep does for me, among many things, is kind of conceptually divides one day from the next. I go to sleep, I wake up, it's a new day. And it really did not feel that way in the Arctic. 10 o'clock at night, 3 o'clock in the morning, 8 o'clock, it was all, you know, varying kind of shades of sunlight, but it was all bright. And it just began to seem like I wasn't really sleeping through the night. I was just taking a nap that happened to be 8 hours long, and I would wake up in the same day again.
Now, that was your perception. Do you think your body was onto it?
You know, I kind of made a conscious choice at some point, and the camp sort of divided up into two groups of people. They were the people who would just ignore their sleep cycle, and, you know, they would work till 2 o'clock in the morning, and then they'd sleep, and then they would just kind of work whenever they felt like working, and sleep whenever they felt like sleeping, and they would just go with it. And there were other people in a group that came to include myself who really started following the clock. Partly it was a function of mealtime. You know, breakfast was 6:30 every morning, and then there was a lunch, and then there was dinner at a certain time. And, like, you definitely wanted to be on track for that. And I just began to feel like I would be a little bit more sane at the end of these 2 weeks if I actually slept somewhat according to my watch. And so my watch actually became, it was kind of like a lifeline in a way from being completely adrift. Even though I kind of went there for the feeling of being completely adrift.
Not so much when you got there.
Not so much when I got there.
I'm speaking with Alan Burdick, the author of Why Time Flies, a mostly scientific investigation. We'll talk more after a break. Podcasts of Tech Nation, Biotech Nation, and Tech Nation Health are available at iTunes, Stitcher, and other podcast syndication outlets. Coming up in the second half of our show on Tech Nation Health, bettering the results for angioplasty and a clinical trial for osteoarthritis in the knee. We'll also hear from our chief correspondent, Dr. Daniel Kraft, on the future of medical education. Stay with us. You're listening to Tech Nation. I'm speaking with Alan Burdick, the author of Why Time Flies, a mostly scientific investigation.
Animals have circadian rhythms, too. You know, they are more and less active at certain times of day. And in the Arctic, in full-on sunlight, you know, when it's sunlight for days and days and days, you can kind of divide up the world of animals into two kinds. And there are, like bees, for example, they keep their circadian rhythm, their 24-hour circadian rhythm, and they basically obey it. You know, when their body says it's time to be active, they're going to be active. And when it's time to rest, they're going to be rest. And you can watch their activity and count out 24 hours, basically. But then something like the Arctic reindeer, normally it has a circadian rhythm, but for those summer months, it completely abandons it with apparently no ill effect. And it just eats whenever it wants, you know, long sleep cycles, long wake cycles. It's one of the few animals that we know about that is able, at least for a part of the year, to completely shed its circadian rhythm.
Now, we've been talking about all this light. You talk about any number of scientific experiments where people go for, like, you know, 2 weeks, 6 months, a long time in the dark.
Yeah.
That's tough.
Yeah, well, it started in the 50s, really. We've known since the 1700s that plants have circadian cycles, and then it became clear that animals do. And so the question was, you know, whether people do too. And it that became clear in the 50s after a series of experiments, first in caves and then in old bunkers, old military bunkers, where they would have subjects go in for, you know, 2 weeks, 3 weeks, no access to sunlight, you know, often no interaction with other people, and watch, you know, and basically monitor their body temperature, because that is, again, the best herald of the circadian cycle, and watched, you know, whether it you know, kept a 24-hour beat or didn't. And it did, very regularly, you know, again, for, you know, 2 or 3 weeks underground without sunlight, and that was sort of the beginning of it. And then there was a French explorer who, starting in the 60s and then later in the 70s, sort of did his own self experiment, where he put himself into a cave first for, you know, 2 or 3 months, and then later in Texas for about 6 months. And you know, I can't say that a lot of useful scientific data came out of it, but he kept very good notes. And his descriptions of his life and his thought process down there is really fascinating and at times harrowing, because he's not, you know, it's not just that he's deprived of sunlight, he's deprived of human contact. And I think after a while, that's part of why it's hard to extract some useful data, because, you know, he's losing part of what's going wrong with his body and his mind is about the social isolation, and you can't really separate that out in the data from, you know, the strange things that are happening to his body.
There are so many aspects at this point to how science is studying time, and I was interested to learn that, like, when your friend feels sad, you feel sad, angry, and that when a friend adopts a particular sense of time or has a particular sense of time, you'll adopt that sense as well.
Among the many things that time is, or our perception of time is the perception of duration. You know, your sense of how long a stoplight lasts, or how long, you know, a blue dot on a screen that I put there for 5 seconds, how long that lasts, you know? And it turns out that sense of duration is incredibly malleable. So if I show you an image on a screen and I move it around, you know, it's up there for a couple of seconds, and I move it around, it's going to seem like it was there longer relative to the same image that's up there statically, you know, just sits there. And an image of a smiling face, of a happy face, will seem to last there longer than an image of a a sad face, even if they're actually there for the same duration. And likewise, an angry face seems to last even longer than a happy face. So part of what sort of twists our clock and stretches out our sense of duration or compresses it is our emotional state. If you watch two people talking and they're pretty good friends, you will see them pretty quickly start to fall into sync in lifting their fork or lifting their coffee mug. And that, you know, that exchange, they're not even conscious of it, but it's a sign of affiliation, of empathy. And you know, the stronger that bond is, the more of that synchronizing you will see. And this happens like a great experiment found that. So if I showed you a series of smiling faces on a computer screen, but I showed them to you in such a way that you didn't actually notice the face, you know, they were sort of subliminally presented to you, you will smile every time that face comes up, even if you don't know that it's there. It's basically empathy. It's a expression of empathy when we kind of mimic each other's gestures. And those emotions that we feel, anger and sadness, they alter our perception of time. And so, you know, when I see a happy face, when I see a sad face, whether it's on a screen or, you know, whether it's on you, I am, to a certain degree, experiencing your anger or your happiness too, because it's like I'm putting myself into your body and feeling what you feel. And with that comes the little distortion of time that comes along with it.
Well, Alan, thank you so much for joining me. Please come back. See you again.
I will. Thank you so much.
My guest today is Alan Burdick. The book is Why Time Flies, a mostly scientific investigation. It's published by Simon & Schuster. I'm Moira Gunn. You're listening to Tech Nation. Welcome to Tech Nation Health, reimagining the future of health and healthcare with the emergence of new technologies. On today's Tech Nation Health, we talk about new efforts in bettering the results for angioplasty and a clinical trial for osteoarthritis in the knee. We also hear from our chief correspondent, Dr. Daniel Kraft, on the future of medical education for doctors, nurses, and everyday people. Many people with heart conditions undergo the procedure of angioplasty. I asked Ken Horn, the CEO of Simic Bio, what is angioplasty and why is it performed?
So angioplasty is a procedure where they go in with a balloon, essentially, and open up the narrowing of the vessel. And that's great, but that causes some injury, which eventually the body is actually going to heal back closed again. Now, today they have stents, which hold it open for even longer, but still the body is going to respond to that like an injury.
Like, what is this stent doing in here?
Exactly. It's a foreign body. And that injury is really unnecessary. And that injury is actually what our first therapeutic, Simic Bio's first drug, is intended to help mitigate, is actually reduce the body's response to this unnecessary injury.
Well, here we have an angioplasty. So we put it in there. Obviously, if we're stretching the blood vessel, there is going to be injury. How can you possibly get in there and make, you know, reduce or minimize that injury?
So it's a great question. So this injury is actually called it's an endothelial lining. It's the skin of your vessel. And when that gets peeled off, much like your skin getting peeled off, your body is going to respond to it. It's exactly the response of the body is, ouch. Now, because they have an angioplasty balloon inside these vessels, that's basically access. Our drug is just flushed through the catheter at the end of the procedure, and it's designed to stick specifically to the sites of injury and thereby shielding it from the body.
So it's sort of like a plastic cover or something over all the injured parts. It's like when you scrape your knee. Your whole knee isn't hurt, just sort of these areas that you can see the red blood or at least the scrape in. And so it just seals off the injury?
Yeah, so that's a great way of describing it. It's a little bit, the drug is a little smarter than a plastic sheet. It does specifically stick to only the injured area, so it's kind of like a molecular plastic sheet, if you will. But once it's stuck there, it does two things. First of all, it makes sure that platelets, these are things that
would
form
normally
blood clots.
Rush there
exactly.
And seal off the wound. Yeah,
yeah, and they stick together and form blood clots, which are fine if you kind of nicked your finger. They're not so good inside your blood vessels. And so we prevent the platelet exposure to the injury, which causes them the body to respond. So that's our primary mechanism.
Now, what happens to the space that was created by the angioplasty, by that inflated balloon? Is that any different?
No. So that's really – so that's the beauty of angioplasty is it very acutely or immediately creates this space. It's all a good thing. The problem is over time that gets scarred back down. And so by reducing the body's response to this small injury on the vessel lining, we're able to preserve that opening that the angioplasty procedure created.
Well, it's sort of like if we take the knee example again, first you've got to get, you know, scabbing over and there's thickness and all of that. And over time, you know, if you've had a real cut, not just a scrape, you see scars. You see the scar lining and it's tougher. That's the same thing that's happening inside your heart.
That's a great parallel to make. So if you stepped on a nail, what you just described would be an absolutely worthwhile response for your body. However, if a highly trained physician in a sterile surgical setting with a sterile scalpel, if she gave you a very clean linear incision, gave you antibiotics and stitched it closed, does the body need to respond in the same way? It really doesn't. That's why despite these highly trained physicians in sterile environments, you end up with surgical incision scars when they really probably don't need to be there.
Where else does that apply in the body?
So the visual I like to give is if you stripped off all the cells from your body, we kind of look like a sponge. And that's all extracellular matrix. It's really a forgotten area of biology. But a classic example that I like to give is in the cartilage. So we all have cartilage. It's kind of the compression element between our joints. And when that gets damaged, the disease state is called osteoarthritis. 10% of Americans have it. 5% are seeking some kind of medical attention for it. It's a huge problem. And unfortunately, cartilage, which is predominantly extracellular matrix, the medical treatments that are available today only help you with your pain. It doesn't help you with the disease. And having ameliorated some of the pain, if anything, the disease tends to progress faster.
So the reason it's progressing faster is your knee or whatever just doesn't hurt so much, so you keep using it.
Exactly. Hey, I'm going to go on a marathon now. I feel great.
That's not so good. So does this help in this case?
Yeah, and this clinical trial just got started, so we expect to be able to generate some data to demonstrate this. But our therapeutic, this is a different drug from our vascular compound, is intended to not only slow the degradation of cartilage, thereby affecting the disease, but also provide some amelioration of pain. Because patients don't show up at the doctor and say, "Doctor, my cartilage feels porous." No, they show up and say, "My knee hurts, doctor. Please make me feel better." And so we need to be able to do both.
So what exactly are you doing in this clinical trial?
So it's a great question. Really, it's really important for us to be able to demonstrate that our drug is going to have a benefit for the patient's pain. Because as I said earlier, these patients are going to show up complaining of knee pain. So that's really the primary endpoint for our first study, is to show that we have an effect on pain. Secondarily, we'll also look at slowing down the progression of the disease. But going back to the trial design, half of our patients will get treated with our drug, injected directly into the knee. By the way, this is a very common route of administration. Available treatments today, which again only affect the pain, such as steroids and viscose supplements, these are all injected directly into the knee. So we'll do the same thing. And then we'll follow these patients for about 3 months and track their pain throughout. And they'll be compared to the control side of this study. We'll be getting a saline injection, or basically a saltwater injection, which is the control side of the study. And the separation between those two cohorts will hopefully demonstrate that we have a positive effect on pain.
So what's a win? You have less pain,
Exactly. We have less pain, but not only that, as I mentioned, we want to look at the progression of the disease as well, because ultimately that's what's going to really benefit not only the patients, but also the U.S. pharmacoeconomic situation. Total knee replacements are a huge problem for the U.S. system, $30 billion a year. Hey, maybe if you're 70, 80 years old, that's acceptable. But if you're 40 years old and you're getting a knee replacement, that is going to cause you problems later in life. I would not call a knee replacement curative by any stretch of the imagination.
And it's highly painful. It's not the same thing.
It is not the same thing. I've talked to many knee replacement patients. By the time they've gotten it, they are ecstatic. because their pain has become so problematic they will take any option. I think it speaks to the unmet need, the magnitude of the unmet need in osteoarthritis is that there aren't options available today. And so what we want to be able to demonstrate and look at in addition to the pain is the slowing down that progression towards ultimately complete loss of cartilage, pain that you can no longer tolerate such that by the end you're like, great, replace my knee. I can't wait for it. And a lot of these patients are extremely happy by that. It's just a very expensive option, and hopefully our drug can help slow down the progression towards that and help, of course, improve the quality of life for these patients, but also save our healthcare system a lot of money as well.
Do you anticipate people will have multiple injections over time, or is this more of a permanent kind of a solution?
Yeah, that's a great question. So OA is a chronic inflammatory disease. You're not going to really make it go away. We expect this to be quarterly injections or something in that sort of interval. Again, we'll have to let the clinical data drive that determination, but we can't make OA go away. For example, in my case, I had an ACL reconstruction in college, and I can't make that go away no matter what pill I take or what injection I get. So I'm going to have OA for life. What I would like to avoid is getting a knee replacement at 40. And that's really the objective for our disease, is to replace some of these more significant surgical procedures for as long as possible until, fine, if that's your last option, so be it. There is definitely a place for that in our treatment triage.
Well, Ken, you got a lot of stuff under examination and lots of trials here, so please come back. Keep us updated, won't you?
That would be great. Please invite me back.
Ken Horn is the CEO of Simic Bio. More information is available at simicbio.com. That's Simic, S-Y-M-I-C, simicbio.com. And now we hear from our chief correspondent for TechNation Health, Dr. Daniel Kraft.
I thought an interesting topic would be the future of medical education, whether that's for the patient, the nurse, the surgeon, the individual, and using some of the amazing new tools that we have in our hands today, like virtual reality and augmented reality and robotics, as we think about the future of how do we educate ourselves as individuals and the medical professionals of the future.
So what does that mean? We all have doctors.
Well, there's actually a shortage of doctors and nurses in many parts of the country and the world. So how do we educate them in smarter ways using some of these new technologies to democratize medical education? And one technology that's moving pretty quickly is this field of augmented and virtual reality, or sometimes blended reality. And let's take some of the most fundamental thing that we all do in medical school, which is sometimes traumatic but hugely memorable, is anatomy lessons, right? You go into the cadaver lab and you just dissect a cadaver, which helps you really appreciate human anatomy, but takes...
However, yeah, takes it out of you.
Exactly. And now we're seeing the ability to maybe replace the anatomy lab with the world of augmented or virtual reality, the idea that you could put on a headset like an Oculus Rift or Google Cardboard and literally be looking inside a virtual body.
And hey, wait a minute. Is that what this T-shirt is you have on?
Well, the T-shirt I have on is an example of blended reality. It looks like a regular T-shirt. There's some sort of boxes on the front. And when you take my smartphone with the app on it, so it's called Virtuality, you'll see through the smartphone, it'll pull in and it'll show you my anatomy or sort of
anatomy. Your heart is beating.
My heart is beating. It's sort of it's blended reality. So on my T-shirt, you now see a virtual version of my lungs and heart, and you can press on the app and now see my guts and beyond. Now, of course, it's not my actual data. But it's an example of blending, in this case, anatomy information overlaying my body. Part of the future of healthcare and education will be to take the patient, and when you see them, have their MRI data, their CT scan data, and literally sort of see through their bodies and help you both leverage diagnostics or do procedures in smarter ways. So not only will medical students and surgeons use virtual and augmented reality to learn anatomy, but to see the actual anatomy and medical issue that their patient has, which can help them plan for a procedure like a surgery or now actually do the procedure. So they're now companies taking, for example, a patient getting back surgery. So the back surgeon is looking at the back of the patient going, well, where am I supposed to start my procedure? Where exactly is that compressed nerve? It's often hard to do that just by looking at the back. Now you could take the MRI data, put on some special goggles, and the surgeon's going to see and overlaying that patient's back where their spine is and where they might need to operate, and maybe even have other cues and clues as to where to go or messages to avoid that blood vessel or other component. So lots of ways these things are coming together.
One of the things that I'm very impressed with is that what we had been learning for the last 200 years didn't really move. That's like you'd open a book and you'd see this is a cell. And, you know, I looked at that for a long time, and then it was really, I confess, it was really only recently that I realized, oh, my goodness, there's all this, it's alive. You know, there are all these things going on. And most people who are not in the life sciences don't understand that. If I take an engineer and I take them to, let's say, a pharmaceuticals manufacturing plant, they learn one thing when it's shut down, and then they learn a different thing when it's in process. And this, like, it says, hey, we're actually going to show you both, you know, but we're going to show you how it's actually operating. You know, that has to be a better education.
And back to the example of anatomy, you can have sort of an unliving cadaver to operate on, but now you can take things like Microsoft HoloLens, which is now working with Case Western to do their whole anatomy lesson. You can sort of dissect that virtual body, but also look at the physiology, change the drugs you're applying to the heart, watch that heart in action fly inside the heart, change the valves if they have aortic stenosis, and look at the impact of physiology, and do that collaboratively, not only with folks in the room, but maybe around the world. Now, let's say the world of surgical education. I was in London 7 months ago with a surgeon there named Shafi Ahmad, who did the first virtual reality recorded surgery. So you'd have a camera above the operation, a great spot to view. I mean, it's usually hard as a medical student to see what's happening. Now they're recording the virtual reality surgery, so you could go back and put on Google Cardboard or other low-cost versions with your phone and see that surgery in retrospect. But they also did the first live stream virtual reality surgery. So over 2,000 people were watching in real time around the world while that operation was going on. So you could democratize the educational piece. And that is so transformative for lowering costs of education or distributing information. But then to enable folks maybe to learn about the anatomy and the physiology of that particular surgery by flying inside the CT scan of that patient and seeing where the issue is. Or a patient themselves, let's say they have high blood pressure, and they don't always want to take their hypertension meds. What if they could see what's happening inside, quote unquote, their kidney or inside their heart or their brain and the impact of hypertension? That's going to change their perspective on what blood pressure means to them and their impetus to take their medication on time. So lots of ways these can change things, and that textbook can now become alive. You can already take things like Oculus Rift and learn anatomy or go inside a cell. I was a biochemistry major. I learned the Krebs cycle, I don't know, a dozen times, and I've forgotten it at least 12 times. What if you could see that Krebs cycle, you know, the way the biochemistry of energetics of energy works inside the mitochondria? Much more impactful and interactive ways to learn.
One thing we've really been looking at lately is this opioid epidemic. And a lot of people get started on that down the wrong path because they're treating pain. Are we going to see some changes in that?
Well, huge topic. We're talking here about augmented or virtual reality. They're actually now demonstrations that you can take virtual reality and use that to reduce the need to take opiates and pain medications. For example, someone has a burn injury, have to go through pretty painful debridements or cleaning of their wounds. There's now been several studies where you put that patient in a virtual reality headset, could be a low-cost one like a Google Cardboard. There's an app where you're in the virtual reality cold environment and you're throwing snowballs, and just sort of being in that cold environment lowers your need for pain meds. It's an interesting example of blending augmented and virtual reality to potentially help pain management, both acutely, potentially chronically as well. We're seeing another form of pain, things like post-traumatic stress disorder, where folks have issues maybe or phobias, being near spiders or in crowded spaces. You can put on a VR headset and be in that crowded subway car or near a spider on the edge of a cliff. And that sort of safe virtual reality experience can be used to treat sort of normal phobias all the way to extreme issues with PTSD and beyond.
There's a lot of things that we may be able to do with virtual reality because it affects your brain. And we've been so oriented to drugs. It's going to be interesting to bring these all together.
Right. The brain-body combination. The technology and the visualizations are getting so crisp that we're passing the uncanny valley. Your brain doesn't know that you're not riding a roller coaster or inside of a red blood cell floating along. And so that gives us tremendous opportunity to help rewire the brain. And, you know, that is, you know, a big game changer. Even the point now we're seeing video games come to impact brain health. You can be in a virtual reality experience measuring your brain waves at the same time. And folks at UCSF, Adam Gazzaley and others, have demonstrated these brain games can improve your ability to multitask or might even help diagnose cognitive deficits or help improve your brain if you have a cognitive issue. Another tremendous application of sort of VR and AR today is things like physical therapy. Folks go home from their knee and their hip implant or anything, and they frankly just don't often follow through their physical therapy. Now, with things like a Microsoft Kinect that can watch your body move and show your sort of avatar on the screen, you can encourage people to gamify their, you know, their leg lifts and their arm extensions and track them and optimize their physical therapy. So there are several companies and academic groups that have blended these together to really help physical therapy be much more effective and used. And that really cutting-edge version of all this is we're going to talk about the future of medical care and the medical visit. That's moving often to these sort of virtual visits. And now there's several apps where there's a virtual avatar where you're talking to an avatar that looks like a nurse. But groups like at USC Center for Body Computing and others have now turned the physician. They can avatar your own physician or your mother or your nurse. And that provides you sort of a more friendly interaction than just a chat bot, for example, and can help change behavior in smart ways, whether to remind you to exercise or to manage a chronic disease and take your medications or to help triage medical issues. So this whole blending of medical education, artificial intelligence, VR and AR coming to your smartphone or to your wearable glasses is going to be quite transformative.
Well, Dr. Kraft, you're an MD. You take care of patients. How you feel about taking care of somebody virtually and they change who you what you look like? They don't like what you look like.
They can always make me better looking.
But oh, so hard
if, that,
to do.
If that works, you know, we want these virtual visits, which is increasingly an important component of healthcare, not just to be, you know, on FaceTime or chats, but to help engage the patient. Digital empathy can come through these. Even if I'm seeing the virtual Dr. Moira, that might help me stay on top of my meds. You don't always have to be there in person to have some of the same benefits. And particularly because no one wants to wait an hour in the waiting room for that average 12-minute visit, we can use these technologies in blended ways to improve health and prevention, diagnostics and therapy, and even clinical trials into the future.
It occurs to me it's not just going to be the doctors. Everybody's going to have a much better idea of who they are.
Well, not only who they are today, but we know with all the wearables and other data, your genomics, that often you might want to change your behaviors. Let's say exercise more, eat less. But behavior change is hard. What if you didn't just see when you looked in the mirror in the morning? You didn't see you of today. You saw you of tomorrow, future you. You if you kept having Twinkies for breakfast and gained 20 or 30 pounds. You if you kept smoking, what your face and skin are going to look like. There are already apps that will allow you to do this. One on smoking from Finland where you can literally see the effects on your face and skin of smoking. Or if you gained 20 pounds or 30 or more. And that can be a major leverage to help people change behavior if they kind of see future self and decide they don't want to have some of those effects.
Well, Doc, thank you so much. We'll see you next time.
Thanks, Moira. And I would encourage everybody out there with augmented and virtual reality to try it out on your smartphones. There's a lot of health and medical and other applications. It's a real area ripe for change and innovation. And one of those examples of the democratization of technology that can impact not just health and medicine and the video gaming industry, but many unmet needs around the planet.
Finally, something good, big benefit other than let's just play a game.
Let's play a game too.
Dr. Daniel Kraft is the founder and chair of Exponential Medicine and chair for medicine at Singularity University. More information is available at exponentialmedicine.com. For TechNation Health, I'm Moira Gunn.
TechNation and its regular segment BioTechNation are produced at the studios of KQED-FM in San Francisco. Executive producer is Matt Gardner. The director of technical production is Monte Carlos. And audio engineers include Howard Gelman, Seal Mahler, and Larry Upton. Our theme music was composed by Ann Nachtrieb-Zesiger and Robert Powell, with title creation provided by NameLab Incorporated of San Francisco. Program information and internet audio is available on the web at technation.com. TechNation and BioTechNation are productions of TechNation Media. I'm Paul Landcor. We'll be right back.